Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of News That You Can Use, the Economic SOS Podcast. I'm your host, Daryl Nobles. This evening, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to listen. And I know you're busy. We're all busy. But it's time we slow it down and pay real attention to what continually is being not told to us, or we're distracted by other things in life that aren't, as in my opinion and many others, vitally important to take notice of. So I'm going to play two short clips and make a comment in between those clips about a period of time that many of us did not live through and may not have even had a conversation with those who lived through by interviews with an excellent journalist, Studs Terkel. And I want, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to listen, because although we're talking about what happened during a very, very tragic period in life, the news that's coming out right now is just as devastating for millions. Bank of America announced they're going to eliminate 30,000 jobs by 2014. 30,000, ladies and gentlemen. Now, most of you that have listened to the podcast before, or even if you've seen this in the news before over the last couple of years, you know that the banks and many businesses don't wait until the end of that time to lay people off. That's just an estimate. That's just their time frame, but it could happen in the next 12 months. 30,000 people are going to lose their job to a bank that got bailed out with millions. News that comes out right now is talking about millions of people, ladies and gentlemen, an overall poverty rate in this country of 46.2 million. 46.2 million, ladies and gentlemen, that are in poverty. And I want to read this and then we'll get to the stories, but this is from a website, aljazeera.net, talking about the poverty rate in this country. In this country right now, the United States, that the highest poverty rate among nations, the highest rate of poverty among rich nations is in the United States, given the widely accepted projections that both unemployment, and in particular long-term unemployment, will continue at high rates for the next several years. We can expect these patterns of poverty to continue, and continuations of low income and high poverty rates for many years to come is devastating. The sad commentary, ladies and gentlemen, is that many of us that are not affected by this seem to think that it's going to get better with the next election, with the next round of budget cuts. But these cuts, ladies and gentlemen, are directly affecting every facet of your life, every single facet, because the banks are looking to shed their bad investments. Oh wait, they got paid off on the bad investments by TARP. They were bailed out, but now they're closing banks, they're decreasing services, trying to push more people to use online banking to decrease the amount of bank positions in the brick and mortar banks that maybe you work at, your cousin, your sister, someone you know, your son. Maybe you know someone that's a manager of a bank that seems to think they're okay. And I guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, if Bank of America is doing this, soon other banks will follow. But the economy turned itself around. The recession was over in 2009, 2008, 2009, 2010. We're still in financial disaster. The super committee that the president created said today that it's going to have to be even more cuts than originally expected if we are to even come close, not to balancing the budget, but just to pay for some of the programs that he's talking about. This $1 billion jobs bill is going to do no more than the last two stimulus bills, ladies and gentlemen. Look at what's really being done and look beyond the smoke and mirrors of what's being said, because around the world, people are seeing things that we don't want to see. The state of Georgia, the third highest poverty rate among states, but yet there's very little attention about that on the local media in depth. This is catastrophe, ladies and gentlemen. So, yes, amidst all of the hustle and bustle that you have to do, whether it's at work and taking care of the children, it's vital, Because if we don't listen to this message of what's really happening around the world, when it gets worse, we have no one to help us, because many of us don't believe that it's going on or it's affecting us. So we don't look out for each other. We don't become our brothers and our sisters' keepers. So let's listen. And as I said, there's two short stories about people's experience during the Great Depression. So if you have children, yes, bring the children to listen to the radio like it was in the old days, where they got real information, not the hype of the television, not the glitz and glamour of the stars giving you bad news but then smiling in your face. That's a psychological technique, ladies and gentlemen, to make them think, or make you think, that they're your friends while they're giving you bad news. So yes, gather them around and let them hear what really happened. Because many of us don't have relatives that are alive that went through the Great Depression, so these interviews are vital for them to listen to as well as for you to hear. So let's get started.
The Great American Depression. What does that mean?
I guess it mostly means a lot of stories that my mother and father told me about times that they had during the Depression. Sometimes aimed at making us straighten up and fly right. We don't have it so hard as they did back in those days, and I had to walk so far to school, and I had to work my way, you know. Other times, just almost like, I don't know, folk stories almost, you know. My mother had a really big family. She was one of seven kids, and she brought me up not on fairy tales, but on stories about what she and her family used to do. And that meant the Depression and other stuff, too. So they feel almost like fairy tales to me, because she used to tell me bedtime stories about that kind of thing.
My mother has a fantastic story, in my opinion, of growing up in the Depression in a small town in central Illinois. And I think this is where times, I don't know, from what she says, and I don't think she tries to glamorize it, is that these were times that were really tough. I mean, it just seems absolutely, it's almost, in a black humorous sense, funny to me, that to realize that, you know, 100 miles from Chicago, about 40 years ago, my mother's older brothers, whom I know well now, were out with little rifles, whether it be a shotgun or a Winchester bolt-action single-shot rifle, hunting for food to live on. And if they didn't find it, there was truly some hungry stomachs. And this is just too much, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think that my generation can really fully comprehend exactly what all this means.
It's weird, because my mom is very much ashamed of the hard times and the Depression, but my aunt and uncle are very different. They're very almost proud of it, and I think a lot of that is because they made it, and they got a lot of money, so they can say, well, I mean, they say to me, because of the work I'm doing, they talk about lazy people. And that my uncle talks about riding freight cars, riding rails, and all this kind of jazz, trying to get through med school. And says,
yeah,
you know,
why can't the others do what I did?
Right, a lot of that. And I know it's very hard. I mean, it causes a lot of tension in our family, because they say that, and I know my parents sit there and think, well, does that mean I'm lazy? You know, and that kind of jazz. And yet they know they've really worked their heart out. And I think, thinking back on that, and on my parents' feelings, and on finding out what happened, had a lot to do with my feeling like you got to have money to make it. And my mom has a habit of having little piles of money stashed away around the house, and we thought that was really weird. And we kind of figured it out that it's like they didn't have it then, so every little bit of thing she gets, she really hangs on to.
It's something that's been filtered through my parents. I don't know much about it, and I think that's, they don't mind my not knowing much about it. They'd rather sort of control this own source of information. Sort of like, I don't know, the high priest, and you can't approach the altar too closely or you'll be struck dead, because they weren't so much aware of the Depression at the time, but since then it's become this Purple Heart in their backgrounds become such a justification for their present affluence that, you know, if we got the idea that they didn't have it so bad, well, then that would be that one less sort of psychological control they'd have over us.
From my father, I know he talks about, like, my father made it finally, you know, and he worked his way up from the bottom. And I think that he feels for him, having gone through the Depression meant that he needed things for security, because he always felt that sense like there was a big black hole out there somewhere you might fall into. And he defends himself to me a lot of times by saying, I need these things around me, because if I don't have them, that might happen again, you know. At the same time, I know for some people it meant that they found out that you're still human even if you don't have money, and what the hell.
My father talks about it didactically, you know, and tries to draw little lessons from it. And he has anecdotes which come up every time the depression comes up. It's sort of this heroic past for them. That's his war.
So many times people like us, young people, are told that idealism is fine for youth, but that there's a point one reaches when he must face up to to the practicalities, the realities of existence. I think that lesson was learned during the depression, at least to my parents, that what actually happened to America was that they were forced at a period of time to give up their idealism, forced to face up to the hard realities of making a buck and staying alive, surviving. This is the lesson that they felt necessary to transmit to us, that the experience of depression is always in the backs of their minds, whether it takes that historical form or whether it just comes out in the fact that one must somewhere along the line give up what he believes in order to stay alive and in order to conform to the pressures of economic realities. And this to me is, you know, exceptionally important when one considers what's called the generation gap. The way in which the depression experience has been communicated to me is secondhand. I've been able to see its effects and not it as an experience. And its effects are what I have repudiated. I repudiated the kind of life that my parents were forced into by the depression.
Well, I was thinking of one other issue. We talked about the value of the dollar being one difference. The other is the word fear. America's always had a lot of fear, xenophobia, anti-communism, and something, the Red Scare after World War II. Fear, 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 fear. Fear, I think, is the thing that people learn from depression.
The things that they teach you about the depression in school are quite different from how it is.
Why don't you talk about that?
You knew that for some reason society didn't get along so well during those years, you know. And then you found out that everybody worked very hard, and so everything somehow just got better. People didn't talk about how the fact that industries needed to make guns for World War II made that happen. It just got better because people all pitched in and worked, and because Roosevelt was a nice guy, even though some people thought he went too far, you know. And you never hear about any struggles that went on. A lot of young people feel angry about that protectiveness, but this particular kind is even more vicious somehow, because it's not, it's wanting you not to have to go through what is a very real experience, even if it's a very hard thing, and wanting to protect you from your own history in a way.
My comments, ladies and gentlemen, is that short segment is very telling about what they went through. And in many ways, it reflects what we're going through right now, but because we don't tell our stories, we don't talk about them, many of us don't believe that they really exist, or many of us are going through this by ourselves. We're going through these challenges and we think, what else can I do? I'm working, I'm struggling, I'm surviving, I'm okay because my job is still here. But ladies and gentlemen, the stories that we're living right now, many of them are very similar to what happened then. It just on the surface looks different because instead of bread lines, we have an EBT or food stamps. It looks different because many of us are living with no lights in the home instead of out in a tent. Many of us are living in our cars when before they were living in tent cities, Hooverville. Many of us don't know where our next meal is coming from, but here comes the government to save us all, because as we talked about before, they're pushing Yum Foods, a corporation that owns fast food chains, are really pushing to have food stamps to be used in fast food restaurants. So now we go from a society where we cook our food, microwave our food, try to cook it in the stove, to a society where we can go and get a dollar menu or a few dollars at a burger joint or from KFC or tacos, and that's supposed to fill us up. And ladies and gentlemen, it's going to kill us. And yes, I'm being a bit extreme and I'm being passionate, because you know as well as I do that eating fast food, do you remember the movie Super Size Me, where the gentleman ate nothing but McDonald's for a month, and the amount of weight he gained, the health conditions, What do you think that's going to do to our children when we start feeding them that, because it's the, we think, the cheapest, best way to solve this challenge? Let's listen to this next story, and then I'll make a final comment about this.
It's like looking into a world where another person is doing those things. And it's just so hard to relate them to myself. And it's really hard to talk about the depression, because what can you say except you were hungry? And I mean, it's hard to make that sound like anything until you're that way yourself, and then you know what it means. But this may sound impossible, but do you know, if there's one thing that started me thinking, it was President Roosevelt's cufflinks. I read in the paper about how many pairs of cufflinks he had, and it told that some of them were rubies and all precious stones. These were his cufflinks. And I just wondered, I'll never forget, I was sitting on an old tire out in the front yard, and we were hungry and so poor. And I was sitting out there in the hot sun, there weren't any trees. And I was wondering why it was that one man could have all those cufflinks when we couldn't even have enough to eat, when we lived on gravy and biscuits. And I think maybe that was my first thought of wondering why. And that's the first thing I remember ever wondering why. But one thing I did want to say about when my father finally got his bonus, he bought a secondhand car for us to come back to Kentucky in. And my dad said to us kids, all of you get in the car. I want to take you and show you something. And on the way over there, he talked about how rough life had been for us. And he said, if you think it's been rough for us, he said, I want you to see people that really had it rough. And he took us over, this was in Oklahoma City, and he took us to one of the Hoovervilles. And that was the most incredible thing. Here were all these people living in old, rusted out car bodies. I mean, that was their home. There were people living in shacks made out of orange crates. One family with a whole lot of kids were living in a piano box. And here, this wasn't just a little section. This was an area maybe 10 miles wide and 10 miles long. People living in whatever they could jam together. And when I read Grapes of Wrath, and that was like reliving my life. And particularly when they were, the part in there about where they lived in this government camp. Because when we were picking fruit in Texas, we lived in a government place like that, a government-owned place in Robstown, Texas. And they came around and they helped the women make mattresses. See, we didn't have anything. And they helped us make, they showed us how to sew and make dresses. And every Saturday night, we'd have a dance. And when I was reading Grapes of Wrath, this was just like my life. And I never was so proud of poor people before as I was after I read that book. And just reading that book has made me a better person. Yes. I think that's the worst thing that our system does to people, is to take away their pride. And it prevents them from being a human being. And they're wondering why the Harlem and why the Detroit. And they're talking about troops and law and order. And you get law and order in this country when people are allowed to be decent human beings and be able to walk in dignity. Every time I hear another building's on fire, I say, oh boy, baby, hit him again.
Do you remember Hoovervilles?
I knew one family there in Oklahoma City. Hmm? A woman and a man and seven children lived on the hole in the ground.
That's true.
They absolutely did.
And they lived in a hole in the ground?
They lived in a hole in the ground. And you'd have been surprised how nice it was. They had chairs and tables and beds back in that hole, and they had the dirt all braced up there, and just like a cave. lived outdoors for a whole year. When my son was born, October the 9th, 1934, we had been sleeping outdoors under a grape arbor from August till October.
My dad wasn't working. My grandfather had a job. This was my dad's father. He had a job in the Cotton Exchange Building in Oklahoma City, and he cleaned up the place after all the big cotton guys, big rich guys, closed their offices at night. He'd go in and clean up. And they had food in a little shack on 22nd Street. It was just a one-room shack. And when my dad couldn't find work, finally we couldn't pay rent. And so the landlady made us move. And so we went out to my grandpa's and my grandmother's, and there wasn't any room for us, so my dad set up beds outdoors. And he ran ropes around the bedposts, and at night, Mama would pile quilts on top. And that's how we lived all summer and up until it started getting real cold.
Do people feel more economically insecure, those who've been through the Depression?
People without money, I mean, feel so completely insecure. I would say so. It's just that I've never had any money. Actually, I've got more money right now than I ever had in my life. And when I came to Chicago, I couldn't make change for a dollar. I got a job in a little beer tavern, and I had to quit before the night was over because he gave me two banks of $3, and I didn't know how to make change, and I was giving them too much. And several people, you know, corrected it. But eventually I lost $6. And because we never had any money. And I mean, when I worked, I wasn't paid in money. I was paid in rent or food stuff or something like that. And you have no idea how proud I was of myself when I got a job as a waitress in a little greasy spoon restaurant. And the boss was a Greek guy, and he put me on the cash register, and it just terrified me, and I told him that I couldn't make change. And so he stood there at the cash register, and he says, "You're not going to walk away from here until you learn how." And I was so proud of myself, you know, and when I count out the change, and especially when somebody would give me a 10, and most of them yell at me, you know, "Hurry up, I'm in a hurry." And I say, "You just hold your potato. I'm responsible for this money." And I'd stand there real slow and count it out, you know, and two or three times before I'd give it to him. But then I learned how to make change. I remember this one Christmas. It was the Christmas of 1936, just before my dad got his bonus. No, it was the Christmas of 35, before he got his bonus in the spring of 36. And we left Oklahoma. We didn't get anything for Christmas. I mean, nothing. Not an orange, not an apple, nothing. And so I just felt so bad. I was so depressed and sad. So I went to the church and to the children's program, and I stole a Christmas package. And it was this pretty box, and it had a big red ribbon on it. And I stole it off the piano, and I took it home with me. And I told my mother that my Sunday school teacher had given me a Christmas present, which she hadn't. And so my mother says, "Well, open it and see what it is." And when I opened it, it was a beautiful long scarf made out of velvet, but it was a cover for a piano. And my mother knew that my Sunday school teacher wouldn't give me that because we were living in one room in a little shack in what they call Gander Flat. And I've looked back on that and how sad that Christmas was with just nothing. And for a child to, I mean, they teach you about Santa Claus and they teach you all this stuff. And then for a child to have to go to a church and steal a present, and then it turned out to be something so fantastic, a piano scarf. Children shouldn't have to go around stealing. There's enough in this country to give all of them everything they want, anytime they want it. And I say that's what we're going to have. I don't think people were put on earth to suffer. I think that's a lot of nonsense. I think we are the highest development on the earth. And I think we were put here to live and be happy and enjoy everything that's here. I don't think it's right for a handful of people to get a hold of all the things that make living a joy instead of a sorrow. When you wake up in the morning and the minute consciousness hits you, it's just like a big hand takes a hold of your heart and squeezes it, because you don't know what that day's going to bring. A hunger, or you just don't know.
Peggy Terry, remembering. A word about the next installment of the series Hard Times in a moment.
And finally, ladies and gentlemen, here's a clip. Actually, here's a article called A Case for Unemployment. The decade of the 1930s saw the Great Depression in the United States and in many other countries. During this decade, large numbers of people lived in poverty, desperately in need of more food, clothing, and shelter. Yet the resources that could provide the food, clothing, and shelter were sitting idle, producing nothing. At the worst point of the Great Depression in 1933, one in four Americans who wanted to work were unable to find work. 25%, ladies and gentlemen, 25% by these statistics. And right now, there's unemployment in many places in the country at not the 9% the government says, but 20%+. We're at Great Depression levels for unemployment, but because nobody tells you this in the media, Fox, CNN, and other stations that you get this media information from, you don't believe it. Further, it was not until 1941, when the World War II was underway, that the official unemployment rate fell below 10%. The massive wave of unemployment hit before a food stamp program and unemployment insurance existed. There were few government programs designed to help the poor or those in temporary difficulty. Further, most wives did not work, so if the husband lost his job, all income for that household stopped. An equivalent rate of unemployment today would cause less economic hardship because of the variety of programs, often inspired by the Great Depression, the cushion of unemployment for poverty. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the article goes on into statistics, which I don't want to really get into reading, but right now, if you go to any search engine and type in unemployment in the United States, some of them you will actually get real information, like the 20%+ unemployment across the country, not the numbers that they're giving you about unemployment, unemployed people that have stopped looking, but total in many areas is 20%. A 16% to 20% unemployment rate for African Americans. In any other country, ladies and gentlemen, with that number of your population was unemployed, it would be a real wake-up call, a real war, not a war on terror, but a war on poverty. And the war on poverty that has been continually talked about is not real. We just went through the dedication, or a primary dedication for Martin Luther King Jr., where people are talking about the wonderful monument in D.C. that was built by Chinese. Where's the economic development in that when there are brick masons, when there are people in this country that could have built it? But the drum major of justice would not be beating his drum for what is happening right now, ladies and gentlemen. He would be outraged that we allow the media and the lies to continue when people are starving. Children are starving in this country. When 46 million people live below the American poverty line, something's wrong. We like to tote statistics. We like to talk about Martin Luther King as if he was some type of person that was just a dreamer. The man was not assassinated for a dream. He was assassinated for going up against a power structure that told him, sit down and stop talking about ending wars, which Obama said he would end, and stop talking about the poor, which everyone likes to say in Washington that they're here to help, but they're decimating the poor. We have got to see what is really going on in this country, ladies and gentlemen, and if we really stand for and believe that Martin Luther King was nothing but a dreamer when he talked about I have a dream as a speech, that was not the whole speech. Listen to the speech. Go on the internet and start doing some real searching and stop believing what you've been spoon-fed, because right now we're at the precipice of disaster. And I know we don't like to talk about it because it's not nice. It's not a touchy feel good. It's not a good program that comes on television to take you away from your troubles. But I guarantee you, if we do nothing, our troubles will be tenfold. We're entering a time with a Great Depression of the 30s. And mind you, when this was going on, what did they have? They didn't have television, they had radio. They had radio programs that talked about the good times. They gave the children superheroes to believe in. They gave you programs that took you away from your challenges. And now we've got a more divisive and diabolical thing called the television, which you watch for many hours of the day, whether you're employed or unemployed, to take you away from your challenges. It's mind control. It's mind numbing. So, ladies and gentlemen, I say to you, and if your children have not listened to this, let them listen to the stories about the Great Depression. If you have grandparents, great-grandparents, talk to them. Find someone who went through this and see that it was not a rosy time. We've got Hoovervilles in this country right now, in parts of Florida, in parts of Illinois, outside of New York City and California and many other places that I haven't even read about, but I'm sure they exist. That people are living in their cars and the police are telling them they can't do that because in some pristine neighborhoods, you can't do that. The shelters are closing, food banks are closing because there's not enough donations, because the people that used to give to the food banks don't have the discretionary, the extra income they needed to feed themselves. So I say to you, ladies and gentlemen, at this time of great challenge, there are solutions. The solutions are, we have got to understand the past, because we are being manipulated. We're being toyed with. We're repeating it because we won't study it. We won't read. We won't listen to real information. So study the past. It's there in front of you, in front of your computer, on your quote-unquote smartphone. Pull up these audio clips and listen to what really happened during the real Great Depression. Because if we don't understand what has happened, many of us will not survive it, because we don't have the safety nets that they had, many of them in communities at least. Our communities are being decimated. Our sense of community is, I have mine, you get yours. And not all of us, of course. There are many people that are doing wonderful things. And we have to connect with those people that are doing wonderful things at the grassroots level. Forget about this hero worship that we call politics. Forget about this idol worship that we call athletes and entertainers, thinking they're going to solve the problems for us. They're not spokespeople to solve the problems. They're spokespeople to keep us pacified and happy while Rome burns. We'll talk on Thursday, but start finding people in your community that can help you survive the challenges that are here right now, because they do exist, and we have got to connect with each other. We've got to find ways to help each other survive the challenges that are here right now.